This is Rafflebix After Hours.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is time once more. Rack Addicts After Hours, most certainly After Hours, but not the usual music store, not the usual pub. One day we will be back. Special episode today. We have our first interview from people outside of our circle of usual work colleagues. Contributions from Akira Shilas, and we are going to be chatting about the new EP Ito later on. That is available on rustedtonerecordings.bandcamp.com/album/ITO, but we'll get in there later. My name's Ben. Pete is with us, as always. We're still missing Andy. I hope he's doing well. He's a busy boy these days. Telmo also very busy with university, but we'll have them back soon enough, I'm sure. Pete, what have you been up to this week? How are you doing?
Not too bad. I've been putting just about anything I can find in the studio through the new Night Sky to see what works.
Of course.
What works best. So I started off with my Sub 37, which was okay, but didn't really suit it. It's a very bass orientated synth, so
yeah,
it's not really
only mono. Well, paraphonic a bit, yeah, but not as harmonic as it might be.
Did a bit of DeepMind. That was quite interesting. I mean, obviously, it's
after you'd put the headphones into the right socket.
Yeah. Yep, that was quite embarrassing. and then lately I've been putting my Motif XF8 through. So I found that...
I forgot you had one of those.
Piano. So it's the best sounding piano that I've got in the studio. So that works really well. So I've been doing sort of grand piano through really ethereal reverbs and things like that. You know, really, really washed out. You know, sort of that haunted piano style.
Nice one. Any beginnings of potential tracks happening?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite nice, and I haven't sort of been sequencing any of it. I've just been sort of plotting out chords and melodies and things like that, and just seeing what works best, seeing what really complements, you know, which particular... There's so many settings. I'm only using the presets at the moment. I haven't really been, you know, I've been having a bit of a twiddle, but I haven't saved anything myself. And at the number one preset, which is the factory one that it comes with, is a really nice clean one with a really long tail. But I've been doing the whole trick with the sustain, where you could put a really high note that's in the same key that you're working in and just sustaining that, and it just kind of hovers, so it gives it some sort of background, and then complementing it with a bass note in the piano and then just playing a melody or some chords over that. Very effective.
Low note, high note, and whittle about in the middle. That sounds good to me.
That's it, exactly. So, yes, I've been sort of... So that's been sort of helping with my guilt factor, you know, that sort of crisis of conscience, wondering why I've got all this equipment if I'm not going to use it.
Well, maybe you should go systematically through every instrument in the entire studio, just so you can make sure you are still using it all. Pop it all through the Night Sky.
I'm going to try the Arp Odyssey behind me shortly. I might try the MS-20, which is next to it. Again, that's a bit that can be a bit bassy in some respects, so I'm not sure. I mean, there's clearly some kind of certain instruments that will really benefit from that type of reverb. I'm going to try the Wave State as well, because it's got some really strange... I know it's already got effects on there, but this is so luxurious, this reverb. It's got to be done.
Do you ever loop pedals into the Moth?
Sometimes. I've done the Big Sky, but I've got some really good modular effects in there anyway. I've got the Tip Top Audio DSP with the Valhalla, which is pretty good. It's got some really long, some of those halls of Valhalla reverbs We've got massive tails, so that's quite good. What else have I got? The Herbverb, which is...
Classic.
Yeah, different. The rest of it's really delays. So I've got plenty of effects, but as I say, I have done the Big Sky on occasions.
Nice one. The Moth, for our listeners that don't know, is Pete's huge custom-built modular Eurorack case. Your theme is all silver. Is it still all silver in there?
No, there's a few interlopers in there. The Make Noise delay, which name escapes me, the little one that I've got
recently. Is it the Ecophon?
Yeah, that's the one. That's lurking in there. And also the Vermona.
Oh, the Melodicer. Did you get that one?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, I forgot you had that. Because you got too impatient waiting for the previously on Sonic, now the Stochastic Instruments one.
Which I'm still waiting and checking the website regularly, but they're still saying they're working through the list. So there's no way of telling it. There's no countdown or anything like that. I may receive an email from them saying that, would you like to buy one of these modules? If I see that they've actually gone on to sort of general sale, I've got the carte blanche to contact them and say, oi, I was supposed to be on the waiting list.
Totally. Well, speaking of the Ekaphon and Herb Verb, we do have quite a fan with us today. Akira, we know that you are a big modular person. You modulared before, and then you unmodulared yourself, and then kind of recently you remodulared once more in the Eurorack world with a lot of Make Noise. I think we'll probably come back to that later. But how's your week been? What have you been up to? Or obviously, we've had a whole couple of years-ish of podcast without you. What's happening these days?
Oh, what's been going on this week? Oh, it's been like Christmas today, actually.
Oh, yeah. Ooh, fun deliveries.
Yes, exactly. I got a new case come through the door. One of the little dope for P6s.
Are those the teeny tiny low cost ones? Or
no, it's
I have to Google.
It's the 6U case that's in the hard case.
Oh, I didn't
know
they did.
So the P6s are the popular ones.
Nice one.
Yeah, I think the original. Like the original Dope for Systems, after they were rack mount, I think, came in just the P6 case. And it's really cute. That is a thing which was a bit of an issue where I live at the moment, because I don't really have much space, with the Make Noise big CV bus case. Because it has quite a big footprint if you don't have much space. So actually going for the vertical rather than the tabletop. Yeah, exactly. So I got that, and then one of their old MIDI interfaces as well for some non-modular connections.
Nice one.
Yeah, and apart from that, preparing for a collaboration that I'm doing with a couple of artists that work in crochet.
Ah, yes, I did see that on the old ModCaf chat. How? Who? Why? What? Improvised crochet just immediately drew my eye. I've never heard of such a thing. And combined with modular or potentially just general experimental music, it can only be cool. But yeah, tell us about that. It sounds really interesting.
Yeah, so it's an ongoing project with two artists, Barbara and Susan, that specialize in crochet. It's a project that's been going on for a little while to raise awareness of Alzheimer's disease. Some of their research comes from looking into the effects of DNA and neurology on Alzheimer's. So they're kind of interested in the connection and the similarities between working with yarn and synapses in the brain and the networks and connections. When they did it before, I believe they did their own music. They saw me performing at the West End Centre in Aldershot.
Our ancestral home as the ModCaf.
Yeah. They asked me if I'd be interested in doing some music with them.
Nice one. Do they have any specific requirements or anything that they're after? Or they just thought, you know, we like your vibe. Make it up as you go along.
I was unsure at first. So I watched their previous video and got a sense of the kind of thing they're after. So music with patterns and development of ideas and repetition. So I was approaching it from sort of minimalist era of music, Steve Reich, Philip Glass, that kind of thing, which modular is quite well designed for step sequences and lots of layering and stuff like that. Yeah, we did a few jams. I sent them some sound, and slowly we've started to get an idea about how this works and what kind of atmosphere we can create. I'm working with the shared system, so it's also trying to make a patch which will last an hour.
Oh yeah, that is quite a that's a long one.
Yeah,
my longest single modular patch I think has been 15 minutes at one of the Brighton modular sessions, and that was stressful enough trying to keep it interesting.
Exactly. Yeah, I've got an idea for a patch to start and end the show, so that leaves me with a different patch that should last about 45 minutes.
Quite an undertaking.
Trying to find, there's a little bit of repatching going on in the middle of it. I'm trying not to do too much changing of patching, because it takes a long time to get from one place to another place,
especially if you have to uncable a lot of it.
Exactly. Some of the sessions that we did where I was doing full patching, starting from nothing and building it up, because they're starting from just yarn and then building up their patterns, so I did the same thing, and I quickly found that I would get myself a bit tied up with one patch and then have an idea about where I want to go, and then think I need to unplug this, but if I unplug that then the sound stops,
the whole thing falls apart.
So then you spend like 10 minutes trying to figure out how to get from one patch to the next patch, and it puts you into a bit of a modular panic, which isn't really what you want when you're doing live stuff. So the modular environment can be an asset in creativity, but a burden if you want to just have something flow and develop and allow for expression outside of that immediate patch.
Totally. Well, it sounds like a good puzzler, and I look forward to Friday. Let me just quickly call up the ModCaf so I can direct our listeners. Is that going to be something that's potentially open for everybody? I didn't actually take a proper look.
It is. It's actually Southampton University are helping us out with this one. So there is an Eventbrite link for it. So you can go to Eventbrite, sign up. It's called Detangling the Knots.
Yes, indeed. Let me see if actually just searching that pulls it up nicely. So yeah, if you search Detangling the Knots, you've got it there, a sound and visual performance. Friday, the 12th of March. Hopefully we'll have the podcast up for then, 8 o'clock GMT in the evening. I'm looking forward to it. Should be pretty cool, I reckon. Let's take a quick jump into the world of news, because we did do some foreshadowing last episode. Pete, do you want to take us through those developments that have occurred with certain helping of the B word?
Yeah, we had two items. Was it last week or was it the week before? I can't
remember. I lose track. I don't know. Time is... time is an illusion. Lunchtime doubly so. That's a...
You'd mentioned that Tom Oberheimer had trademarked his several names that were associated with him. So Oberheim and OBXA. And it would seem that my sort of slightly cynical response to that is most probably he was defending himself against Behringer was actually correct.
Yeah.
Because Behringer have had a ruling against them in court saying that they're not allowed to use the name Oberheim.
The omnipresent predatory beast that is Uli Behringer's company.
Yeah, so it was stated that it was too firmly associated with Tom Oberheim and the products that he sells, and considering what products they wanted to associate them with. Strangely, as it stated, he hasn't trademarked them in the Europe at all. They're just in the US. Mm-hmm. But I think that will be effective enough to... the reports are suggesting that it will be effective enough to force Behringer not to call it an OBXA and to possibly change the colour scheme.
Ooh, colour scheme, that's interesting. Yeah, I'm pretty sure from their... all their prototypes that they've been chucking about, it did have a bit of the old the blue pinstriping going on. So suspicious, that one.
Yeah, so we've yet to see. I mean, the format was obviously different. It was in the small sort of skiff type arrangement that they've been doing with some of their tributes, I'm supposed to say. And the other bit was, I was saying that there was nothing on Tom Oberheim's website other than pointers towards the sequential OB6, but there is an announcement on there that he's going to re-release the Two Voice Pro, but that will be later this year, price to be announced later. So I'm thinking that's going to be quite pricey.
I assume, given that there's not exactly a lot of them kicking about and things, it's sort of a pretty small operation what he makes himself.
It's got to be at his age.
Well,
I can't imagine
himself in inverted commas.
Himself sitting there with a soldering iron. It's got to be subcontracted out and built to his design specifications. But the actual Two Voice Pro was initially released in 2015, and it apes back to the original Two Voice, which I think is back in the 70s. I'm sure when I last looked, there was something like 4,500 when they were on there. So, and this one's a limited edition with his signature on it. So I'm thinking 5,000-6,000 anywhere in amongst all those numbers. A lot of many monies, basically.
All of the monies.
So as much as I would like one, I won't be buying one. Although maybe at a later stage when they're no longer available, I'll be cursing it and go, why didn't I buy one when I had the chance?
Yeah, when they've doubled their price on eBay and Reverb and things.
Like all the other things I should have bought.
Yeah, like that Schwaemann.
Yeah. And the re-release of the 2600.
Oh, yeah, the big full-size one.
Yeah, should have bought one. But there you go.
Have they all gone now?
We got 9 in the shop eventually.
Okay. Well, that was a decent return on trying to get as many as we could.
Was it 150 just in Europe or 150 worldwide they were making? It wasn't many.
No, it wasn't a lot. Did you get a chance to play with one?
No, I know you did because you got one. Yeah, I know. But, I mean, we had a heads up and I could have got one. Yeah. And I just, for whatever reason, I just thought, you know, I've got the TTSH kit waiting in the wings to be built.
Just like you've got a Lyra 8 kit waiting in the wings.
Yeah, I know, I know.
Soon you're going to get a Deckard's Dream and there'll be some PCBs for that.
I was contemplating the Deckard's Dream today because Lolpop has just done a review of the Deckard's Dream.
Oh, has he? Right, right.
This week. So he's done a review of the Mark II, which they sent him sort of slightly cheaper. Don't know what he got it for. And with links to Thoman, who had some B-stock ones as well. But it's a lot of money. What's it? It's north of 3,000, isn't it?
Yeah. What about, I mean, the kit's not really something to sniff at either. I think it's over a grand still if you get the case and everything, isn't it?
That would be interesting, but there's a hell of a lot of surface mount and it's on both sides of the board.
Ooh, yeah.
So, I mean, I don't mind a little bit of surface mount, but to that extent, it would be scary because all the money you had invested. Imagine if it didn't go well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it depends on the package sizes and things. If it's nothing too intimidating in terms of its miserable tininess, if there's just a lot of it, it's not too bad.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you took your time and really, really took your time, it's just something that size, it's the calibration at the end of it, getting it all right. Yeah. I mean, there's something to be said for having a fully built unit that you know that's been fully tested, fully calibrated, and comes with a certain amount of warranty. When you're spending that much money.
Yeah. That's the thing. I'd love to tackle a big project like that, but, you know, there's the money and that kind of worry. But then you think, okay, maybe we'll do an interesting Eurorack module. But then once you get into the that kind of thing, there's, as you mentioned, the precision calibration, which you need a lot of extra equipment for. Then flashing firmwares is something that scares me quite a lot with some of the weirder ones. I know there's a lot
I mean, with the TTSH, it's all through hole, so there's nothing that scary. And I'm going to all the chips will be mounted in standoff, so if there's something wrong, you just pull the chip out and put another one in.
And you won't have to do, you won't go mad doing voice cards or something, you know, getting the deja.
No, it's all on the one board. It's all on one board.
It's multiple boards on the Deckard's Dream, though, I think. Like little fingers.
Well, I believe in the Mark II, what they were saying was it's one board and it's double-sided.
Ah.
So the side with the control surface has got a lot of electronics in between the sliders.
Yeah.
And then on the back of it's got more on it. And it's all, as I say, it's all surface mount, or a good proportion of it's surface mount. So there's a lot that could go wrong.
Yeah, no thanks to that project. Let's jump over to a couple of new releases that have been floating around. This one potentially not new release, but, you know, the sneak peek. This will be coming soon, maybe, perhaps, probably, but you probably won't be able to buy it. It'll be horribly expensive. Mike Beauchamp, or however else you might say the name, if I've done the surname wrong, is making a Theravox. So inspired by Ons Martineau and Electro Theremin. This is something I've seen the various bits of before vaguely in other places, and I haven't really done the delving into, but it's just a slightly different and quite intriguing control method for a reasonably basic synthesizer. But the deal with the Ons Martineau was a little ring that has kind of a string on both ends, and you kind of hover it over a representation of your standard chromatic keyboard to get your chromatic stuff going. So you can do really, really smooth glissandi, I don't know, you can get a little bit microtonal on there if you want. The other interesting bit is there are some control lozenges, whatever you want to call them, on the left, which are kind of pressure sensitive in a way, but they have quite a lot of travel, so there's a really nice control that you can get there for, you know, volume or opening up a filter or something, kind of similar to what you can get on the Expressive E Touché and that wibbly thing on the side of the Polybrute. It's that kind of really hands-on expression, so there's a lot of control there. And this is,
does it, it doesn't have the keyboard then?
No, it just has the, you know, the flat picture, although that you kind of hover your finger over. But based on this video, there might also be buttons. So for the slightly less coordinated of us, that might give you a little bit of a crutch if you need it.
So that's something about the Ond Martineau that I didn't realise. I thought that the thing about that was the little ring that slides up and down. But actually, the keybed moves from side to side. And it has a very, very particular action to it, so that if you press a chord and then sort of wobble your fingers, you can get a vibrato.
Lots of interesting control methods.
It's a really good idea. It's a shame people haven't continued with that.
Yeah.
I imagine it's a really, really difficult mechanism to...
Most to likely.
...mass produce or something, because I guess everyone relies on a few companies making keybeds, right? So
totally. I mean, the only other thing that... I'm not going to include the Roly stuff because it's just weird and expensive and annoying. But there's the that
and Continuum.
No,
that thing,
that other thing. Because the Continuum's kind of similar to the Roly stuff, but not textured, and it's like neoprene or something. But
there's another thing.
No. The Osmos. That's what it's called.
Yeah, the Osmo. Yeah, That was we've been threatened with that last NARM.
Yeah, ages ago. I mean, but that is
2020 NARM.
Yeah, that's a collaboration between Expressive E and Harken. So it's got the Continuum synthesizer engine in it, which I can't remember the name of at the moment, but that has individually wibbly left and right keys for its poly aftertouch stuff. So yeah, this is a full synth. It's got, there's wood in there, it looks very handmade, probably very expensive, but yeah, different control methods. Just nice to see some vintage history type things available again.
I haven't seen one. Have they been released?
A sneak peek, so it's prototyping and it's probably going to be limited run, all that kind of stuff. But yeah, that's on YouTube, so definitely go and have a gander there. It's got it's because of the way it's made, it's a very flat top and it's quite a spacious panel, so ample space to put weird pedals on top as well. Speaking of weird pedals, a very strange company called Folktech have two new pedals, both of which are the same format, same control surface. They are called the Alter X and Y. This is a crowdfunding, give us money, we'll make the things, and it'll probably be fine, because Folktech have made stuff before, they know what they're doing. Responsible for the Mescaline, which is really strange and weird and fun, breadboard patch cable type situation. These are DSP-driven effects pedals. They've got seven algorithms each. Arius Blaze and Nico Raftis are the two people spearheading this project. They've both got a lot of delay kind of stuff going on. So the X is going to be long delay, tight delay, a notated granular delay, huge plate reverb, shimmering reverb, distortion and multi-filter, pitch delay and stutter glitch. And then the Alter Y has analog delay, analog style, because these are all digital pedals, reverb with infinite capture and low-pass, high-pass filters, choral reverb, palindrome reverse delay, which is a backwards-forwards repeat in the same delay, which is kind of fun, time stretch, pitch shift, notated semitones, and a time stretch glitch. There's a few sort of sneak peeks on YouTube at the moment. We've got one from Justin Melland, one from Red Stripe Down. Very ambient, and they sound actually amazing. Unfortunately, it's Folktech, so they're going to be really hard to get hold of, limited edition, and will probably only be made once, and it's kickstarted, so it'll take forever if you want to get hold of them. You can get both pedals for $400, apparently after October 2021. Who knows when we'll actually see these and if we'll see them in any real numbers. But I definitely think you should check out the YouTube videos, because they sound really, really cool. That's it on the synth news world. Any newsworthy bits that any of you chaps have come across recently?
No, I'm all done.
Yeah, I'm out as well.
I guess I've been going in the opposite direction and looking into the old era of Eurorack, because it almost seems there are still quite a few companies from the beginning that are around. But there's also a whole bunch that just don't exist anymore, and a whole load of modules which were very interesting that rarely get referred to if you're on any forums or blogs or anything, or watching any YouTube videos. It's very much the new stuff.
Yeah.
You don't really see much of the old stuff. I got in contact with Andrew Kilpatrick.
Ah, I know the surname.
And he still makes the K4817 pattern generator.
I don't know,
I think
at
that's
all.
The number. Do you not know? Okay, yeah. So this
no,
was.
No, I mean, it was a string of numbers. I'm really bad with that kind of thing, so I wouldn't remember.
Oh, right. Do you know of the pattern generator?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I know of pattern generators, but absolutely not the one you're referring to.
Right. First time I saw it was in the I Dream of Wires documentary. and it's the interview with Richard Devine, Devine, one of the two.
Yeah. Can you just give me that model number again? I'm going to quickly hunt for a picture.
I think it's K4817. I might be wrong. Don't quote me on that.
Looks like there aren't many great matches for your search, says Google.
Okay. Kilpatrick pattern generator should get you there. I thought this thing had been discontinued because you haven't seen it in shops in years and years. But I got in contact with him and he still makes it. And he added international shipping to his website, so you can buy them. So I'm keen on one of those. They have a very unique way of making patterns that looks quite fun and intuitive and not too technical or menu divey. Mm. But this is a thing with some of these older modules that tends... They're before the whole YouTuber modular scene. So this is back when demos of this equipment were still a dimly lit room with just a phone camera picking up the audio through the speakers.
And not a cactus or succulent to be seen.
Exactly. No soft focus, none of that. Or gritty. So I thought that was quite interesting that Kilpatrick is still going and still making that particular module. So that I got quite excited about.
Yeah,
that.
No, I mean, looking at it, I totally recognize it. The kind of grid-based multi-segment display is kind of distinctive right in the middle there.
And this is continuing on from the ModCan Dual Wave, which I just bought, which is delicious.
Yes, indeed. actually, before we jump into nattering a bit about Ito, I've known you in this particular modular era of your life, but you, as far as I know, you had some, you have some like 5U or something a while ago, and you might have Eurorack once before. What's your history with the modular world, if I may?
I was a vintage synth person for a long time, and I remember visiting a friend who was living in Berlin, and we went over to Schneidersladen.
Hallowed grounds.
Yeah, and I knew that this place existed because I think I'd been listening to a podcast with Ricardo Villalobos, and he was talking about the modular. So I went to this place and was confronted with all of this stuff. There was some modular there. I remember there was a lot of Pittsburgh stuff. There was a Buchla 200E that I didn't play. I walked straight past it and didn't even think twice. I did not know what I thought was just another modular synth like the rest. The thing I was drawn to the most was that there was a Synthesis Technology MOTM system just in like a 19-inch rack case, just probably below the Buchla, just sitting on the floor. Yeah. And I remember asking Herr Schneider, what's this thing over here? And apparently it got sent to them, but everyone was so into Eurorack that they weren't really giving the 5U stuff a glance. But I saw it and saw the similarities it had with, I had a Roland SH-09, I think, and a few other sort of older, big, chunky synthesizers and liked the retro feel. I started looking into that, but being, you had to get over from America and it's quite expensive. Yeah. So I found Oakley Modular that made MOTM stuff. So I went quite crazy and built myself a 10U 5U system that is just very... it was very subtractive. Mm. I was, into filters and waves, square waves and things. So I had that for a bit and then just ended up selling it because it just seemed to be a lot of money for a monosynth.
Oh, yeah.
And I was also, I was starting to use Pure Data and things like that a lot more around that time. And I was a bit more interested in the things which I could do with that. I think coming back into it later in the game and trying out Euro instead has definitely expanded the possibilities and being able to sequence and do effects and do everything within a single system. Yeah. And especially with the Make Noise stuff, which is very Surge style in its patching, very sort of problem solving and patching things and strange feedback paths and stuff like that, as opposed to having it go sequencer to oscillator to filter. And what was the question? I've gone way off on a tangent.
I don't know. We totally do like rambling on this podcast and it's always a good journey. I think I was just asking generally how you modulared before ModCaf, because that's the time frame I've got.
Yes, that was 2013, I think, when I had the 5U system. So this is just when Euro was starting to kind of peak over here.
Nice one. Coming to the present, we have a new EP. Rusted Tones, little local tape label, have produced a wonderful little... love the noise. Anyway, I've got a few questions for you, if we may. Please ramble as much as you can.
Okay. Okay, I'll try.
So, reading the blurb, Pete and I have both had a good listen. So, Pete, if you have any questions as well, feel free to chuck those in the mix. But the first bit that I wanted to visit is from the blurb. We have the little phrase, themes of time and place. Looking at the titles, The Swale, that obviously seems like a place. But how, in various tracks, if we pick any of the ones that you would like to expand on, should you like to go into that, you've got in your brain, you're in a place that you might identify a time, emotion, a memory or something with, or potentially you're just trying to encapsulate a time in your life. How do you take that very internal, cerebral, emotional something and then go and make bloops and pretty noises and pick reverbs for it? What's your typical process like, if you even think about it at all? If it just kind of happens, you're like, oh yeah, I accidentally did that and it was amazing, then let us know. But take us down that journey, okay, if you may.
So I was hoping with the blurb that it meant that I could basically just say something and then I wouldn't ever have to sort of explain what I mean.
Well, obviously, tough. Totally, now you're going to have to do it.
It's so hard to talk about the why of the music and the meaning behind it when there's no narrative that's explained in a common language. I guess music is a sort of a common language, but it's more interpretive.
We are all, of course, big gear nerds here, so if you prefer to just go down the gear route, we're all on board for that kind of thing as well.
So imagine you've gone on holiday, or even better, a place that you visited as a child that left a very lasting impression of you. So there's a certain atmosphere that you experience when you're in these kind of places, and they have an inspirational effect, and there's all of the different senses that happen whilst you're at this particular location. So it might be something like an estuary, some kind of, you know, place of natural beauty or something like that. And there's all of these different factors that come into play when you're experiencing a place like that, such as who you're with and your experiences that have happened before and after. And there's all of these other senses happening as well, like the temperature and the different sounds and noises that are going on. But all of those things are happening, I guess you could say, factually, and they're happening externally. And if you're with another person, they would also be able to sense their things. But then your thoughts and the other person's thoughts are happening in their minds. So there's this thing that's between what's going on in your head and there's the things which are actually happening out in front of you. And it's this connection between those two things, which is the phenomenological experience.
I'm on board. No, I'm following, totally.
That's the thing which I'm trying to maintain, to keep alive in music.
Gotcha.
If I can make a track that makes me feel or sense that same experience that I had when I was actually visiting this particular place, not just an experience you have every time you go there, but one particular memory of being somewhere at some point in your life, if you can create some music which allows you to keep on remembering that moment the way that it felt rather than the way it just looked, then that's the sort of aim of a lot of my music.
So dark magic is what we're really getting at here. No, I love it. No, I totally understand what you mean. That's a weird thing to have to try and wrap your face around, but that was a really good explanation. I totally get. So now let's go totally different tack. Let's get some gear nerdery in there. What tools helped you visualize, auditory analyze? I don't know. You know what I mean.
Let's talk synthesizers.
Yeah.
There are three synthesizers on it. There was a Yamaha DX7. There was a Yamaha TX81Z.
The slightly different but very similar staple.
Yeah, and a Kawai K1.
Uh-huh, yes, I forgot you had that.
I got really into programming these, particularly the DX7, and wanting to program patches and sounds in it which were somewhere between, I guess, consonants and dissonance. because you can get to places where you might get to those sort of sounds if you're using analog and subtractive synthesis using some kind of FM or AM stuff. But there's a particular quality to doing that kind of thing in FM, which can end up sounding, I hope it sounds warm. And trying not to use the DX7 to make just, you know, bell sounds and roads.
Yeah.
I like those sounds. But I just got really into the zone of basically doing a DX7 patch a day.
Oh, yeah.
And having a melody which was then attached to that patch.
So, well, you've heard it here first. A DX7 patch a day keeps the doctor away.
Oh, yeah. It was for effects. Mm. It was a Boss, one of those Boss micro rack.
Oh, the little half rack doodads.
Yeah. Nice. And a quadriverb.
Classic.
And it was sequenced on a Roland MC300.
Oh, yeah.
And I still have all of those tracks saved on floppy disk.
That is what I like to hear.
It was very not modular.
So are these vintage things that you've had for some time or more stuff that you've picked up in the last few years? Because you said you were into vintage at one stage.
Yeah, these are things I've picked up in the last few years. I have a long, long list of things which I've bought and sold over the years.
I know the feeling.
I've moved around a lot, so I've tended to acquire lots of things, and then I'll have to move, and then I tend to reduce my footprint for those kind of events. It's probably a good thing that I don't still have everything. Some of the things I got and found a bit of a challenge to program, but I think it was just where I was at musically at that time. It wasn't a thing which I was particularly interested in. I've had a Kawai K1 before, and I thought it sounded rubbish and it was a nightmare to program. But then I bought another one, and I realized that it's so good at making kind of lo-fi pads that sound like they've been sampled off old VHS tapes.
That's so specific. I love it.
But there's a real particular character to it. I recently bought a K1 again because I sold it to a friend because I'd made Ito and I thought, I don't need this anymore. But I missed it so much, so I bought it again. And this is the same time a Arturia Micro Freak arrived.
Ah.
And I had a play on that, and the Micro Freak went back and I kept the K1.
Love it. Do you find quite a lot of inspiration in challenging programming or general gear usage?
It's a bit of a double-edged sword, I think. It's kind of nice to sit down and really go on a bit of a journey exploring a synthesizer. And if you're really into it, if it's something that brings you joy as an object, if you experience the aura of it and you're kind of won over by its...
Well, the hippiest thing you could probably say now is maybe the id of your new, I don't know, but I'm on board with the hippiness of this at the moment.
It's really interesting, and it's something that we get a lot with synthesizers, and they're particularly rich because there's all of this history that goes into it, and they're almost kind of sacred objects. And to be in the presence of, you know, something like a 909, you experience this thing like this rare object, has lots of different values attached to it, not just the fact it's worth £2,500 or whatever. There's all of these other valuable things about it. So if you have that with your instrument, then you're more willing to make compromises, and you can actually enjoy the experience of something which other people might find maddening to program because you've got a sentimental relationship with it. That did sound really hippie-ish, didn't it?
And I love it. If only you could go back in time and bask in the presence of that 200E that you didn't know. One more bit on the EP. I think my favourite track ended up being Keys. I think it's probably because of my prog rock upbringing that a long track always works for me, because I like stories and sort of something that feels like it has a journey in it.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what grabbed me on that particular track. But I wanted to ask, when you are consuming music, are there particular features that tend to hook you in? Obviously, in the world of pop music or more contemporary stuff, there'll be a catchy lead line or some fun guitar riff or something. But this is specifically an experimental, weird music question. When those features might be absent in something that's potentially a little bit more abstract, maybe a bit noisier, in the experimental music world, what are the things that tend to grab your ear?
I'd say that maybe the question isn't applicable because I don't listen to music.
At all?
No.
Hmm.
I've listened to a lot of music, and it got to a point a few years ago where out of the blue I developed bilateral tinnitus.
That does not sound tinnitus. Fun at all.
I was literally just sitting in my room, and then one of my ears started ringing, and it never went away. And from that moment, I started to become very precious of silence. So for the most part, it's manageable. I have a very, very strong interest in sound and music and its history. Mm. And I like making music because it means I get to experience sound and mess around with this thing that I'm so interested in. But outside of that, I really, really like just silence and just peace and quiet, because it's kind of difficult to get peace and quiet now. Mm. There's always sounds happening everywhere. So I make the most of it when I can have it.
An answer I totally did not expect, but I suppose that does lend a certain extra special something to the music that you do and end up making. I suppose there's a little bit more. I don't want to use the word reverence, because that sounds too worshipy and weird, but I suppose it's a little bit more of a special process that I didn't realize. But thank you for sharing on that one.
There's something that seems somewhat heretic or blasphemous about being a musician that doesn't listen to music, but I do out of interest and during research and things, I'll listen to it and experience it. But it's not something I try and keep up to date with or involved in.
Hmm. But I suppose if you are listening to something, if you go to a friend's gig or analysing your own performances, I suppose you're going to have quite a different perspective to the vast majority of people as well.
I think that can get in the way sometimes, is that when you start making music and you treat it as a craft that you need to get better at or improve on, listening to music becomes a form of analysis rather than just enjoyment, and that can actually get in the way of being able to just enjoy music just for itself.
Well, that's a sentiment that we've talked about quite a lot on this podcast. I mean, I don't listen to music either. Yeah, I work in a music shop and I spent a small fortune on equipment, but I don't listen to music at all.
When was the last time? Because I'm assuming you did listen to music for it was a big important thing in your life, and then you sort of stopped.
I haven't listened to music for entertainment for 20 years.
That's really interesting.
And you learn something new about Pete every day.
And it's the same. I mean, some of the same things. One, I found it distracting, and I much preferred listening to the spoken word. Also, it was exactly the analogy you used. When I do listen to music, I'm just forensically examining it and slicing it up and trying to work out the production techniques and things like that. And it's not enjoyable. Mm. Can't just listen to music for music's sake anymore, because you're so sort of invested in the production side.
It's like it shifts from the when you first get into it as a teenager and as a young adult, and it has this really big emotional impact on you. As you start to get interested in it as a hobby and as something that you participate in the creation of, it seems to shift over to this more problem solving part of your brain.
Yeah, and it's a chat. How do I get this sequencer to work? How do I get this thing to clock properly? How do I get this thing in tune? It's a technical challenge.
I think that's a unique place for people that make electronic music to be, is that you are dealing with both sides, this technical mathematical side of the technology and the emotional side of making the music itself, depending on the kind of stuff you make, I guess.
I mean, I've said before, I will hear things. I mean, something will catch me out. I'll hear maybe a little bit of backing music in a movie or something else where there's some incidental music, and I'll particularly hear a quality or something in it that grabs me, but immediately I want to know how they made it and how I can reproduce it or do something similar in a sort of selfish way, rather than I don't want to keep listening.
Tam,
to
we
it
really
over
need to get
again.
Telmo in on this one, because he's somebody who is both really absorbed in the listening and enjoying, but also the really technical analysis and bettering himself in the craft of,
but that's in a more traditional technical,
the classically
trained musician
kind of corner of the world,
technique.
I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. Not some, and although there will be certain technical challenges, not to the same extent where you're, sometimes just crawling under the desk in amongst all the wires.
Yeah,
trying to work
you've
out
just plugged in a new pedal and you've no idea why. There's nothing coming through your headphones and there's no reverb. I keep bringing that one up further because it cracks me up every time.
Yes, it's that. Yeah, I know. I'm really getting over the shame of that.
Anyway, fantastic to be able to actually chat to you about this one, Akira. So that will be Ito by Akira Shilas, available on Bandcamp. It's something that you probably want to lie down on your back in the middle of the floor in your living room, and I think it warrants a single origin pour over for the really lame coffee nerds. Take your time over the brewing of your chosen beverage, lie back and absorb. Definitely worth your time. Like I said, Bandcamp, rustedtonerecordings.bandcamp.com /album/Ito. Thank you very much for joining us and nattering away. So that rounds us off towards the tail end of Rack Addict After Hours episode 63, and that means it is time for the miscellaneous multimedia recommendation. How many times can I emphasize the letters M without sounding like a complete moron? I'm actually ready to go first with mine for once, because I am prepared like a real adult who actually plans his life and, you know, does normal things like a responsible human. I was hunting around on the YouTube world, as I do, which I'm trying not to do. Why am I doing this to myself? Anyway, I came across Moritz Klein, that is M-O-R-I-T-Z, and then a space, K-L-E-I-N. I have no idea what this guy does, because I came across him a while ago. A while ago means about 45 minutes ago. Not many videos on the channel, but they're all relating to electronics, and very specifically to synth DIY, and most pleasing for me, they come in right at the super basic, you know, absolutely nothing, you didn't pay attention in your physics A level, why don't you understand electronics yet, but we're going to teach you how. But this one, I've started on DIY synth VCO part one, how to design an oscillator core from scratch. And it's engaging. It's got good explanations. It's all breadboarded. It's nicely filmed, and it's actually grabbing my interest. And I'm excited to go and make I think my breadboard still has a really low budget and terrible Vactrol that I made with an LED and LDR and some electrical tape, which I think kind of works. But either way, I'm excited to get back into that kind of stuff. Maybe one day I can make something interesting that may or probably won't impress our good friend Jake Ellsgood, who makes very cool bits. Anyway, synth DIY stuff, the channel is Moritz Klein, and it seems to be very, very high quality stuff. It's got all, you know, your YouTube chapters, and what else have we got in here? There's designing a diode ladder filter from scratch. That sounds really cool. I might jump the gun and head there next. He's got multiple parts for this VCO thing. So there's a wave shaping thing. There's a temperature control type thing. How to build a DIY 3x VCO module from scratch. So I'm on board. I'm very excited. Ooh, he's got one about arpeggiators as well. Anyway, what else have you guys got? Who's first?
There's a YouTuber that I actually found through through the Lines community, who runs a channel called La Synthese Humaine. Is a chap that explores, he's got a surge system, and he's really interested in the cybernetics of Norbert Wiener, and he does a few sessions talking about using the synthesis applications of cybernetics and self-regulating systems. Also talks a little bit about things like Marxism and dialectics. Very interesting, a really nice take on modular synthesis that puts it alongside sort of a more theoretical or critical theory.
Using that other genre. Bit of the brain once more. I thought, hang on, I've totally, yeah, I know about this. I've come across this before, and then realized actually you told us about it on the last ModCaf catch-up, so that's that's why it was so familiar. Nice one. What have you got for us, Pete? Actually, quickly, let me spell out La Synthese Humaine, because I botched it horribly when searching YouTube for it. That'll be L-A space S-Y-N-T-H-E-S-E space H-U-M-A-I-N-E. We're not on YouTube, so we can't do little annotations and things. You just have to spell it out. Enjoyable stuff. Pete, what you got for us?
Right. My recommendation for this week feeds into the joy of watching people doing things really exceedingly well, which we've talked about in the past, where people are highly skilled at what they do and there's a certain pleasure and just, in fact, it's relaxing, we've suggested in the past, where you can just watch these people. I think it's the fact that when you can see someone working in who's so competent at what they're doing, it's just relaxing. You've got no fear that anything's going to go wrong. Anyway, I've been getting into a bit of fine art restoration videos. Now, you get the usual sort of fare from the sort of the National Gallery in London and several museums in New York and other great capital cities around the world, where they're spending a lot of time going through a few techniques. But this is an independent gentleman called Julian Baumgardner, and he's a fine art restorer who works out of Chicago. And he's been doing a selection of videos highlighting some of the works that he's been doing. But he will do it in several ways. There's no live commentary as such, although he does run commentary all the way through, but he does it in post-production. Some of the elements will be time-lapsed, so it doesn't get tedious, but he will go through the whole process of restoring a piece of art thoroughly, and it's quite absorbing, and you know, the complexities of doing it. I mean, he's got an exceedingly well-equipped shop. He's got various sort of tools, which I think they're mostly standard in the art restoration world, but I've not seen them before, like vacuum tables, where you actually sort of treat the artwork and then vacuum it under sort of polythene to try and get rid of the wrinkles. And he's sort of squishing things out, rebacking canvases with new canvas stuff, removing old varnish, cleaning. But then he does the full repainting. These things will look like, it could be ripped into several pieces and completely deteriorated. And he'll bring it back to almost looking like a new.
Oh, wow. So yeah, not just the quick touch up, the full rescue.
All the materials he uses are removable. Traditionally, in the past, when paintings have been restored, they've been done badly. If you know what I mean, with inappropriate materials and so forth. And he will use, as I say, all the materials he uses are all removable. If at some point in the future they wanted to reverse the process, it's very absorbing. And also his commentary delivery is very. It's almost got an ASMR quality to it, which is a point not lost, because I think one of his videos actually mentions ASMR. But I've found them, they're very relaxing, because some of them are quite long. I think they're up to an hour, and some of them are two-parters. But you can kind of just have it on and just sort of letting the commentary wash over you, or you can actually just sort of zone out watching what he's doing. And although it's very long-winded, it's for some reason it doesn't get boring, and it's really relaxing.
Nice one. Well, it's kind of similar to that corner of YouTube I've skated over before, which is people restoring things like knives and old axes and stuff, but hopefully without the horrifying noise of an angle grinder for, you know, half an hour.
No, and again, you don't generally hear the sounds, because he's, as I say, he's done, after the editing, he's done the commentary over the top at a later stage. So, I mean, he's even got sort of big table saws and that. He'll reframe it or re-engineer the original frame. I mean, it could be a 200-300-year-old actual frame for the canvas, and he'll sort of modify it or use it, or he'll build a new frame, you know, whatever he needs to do. So he's competent all the way through all the skill sets. So it is called Baumgardner Restoration, and I'll spell that B-A-U-M-G-A-R-T-N-E-R. Baumgardner Restoration.
Nice one.
On YouTube.
Well, thank you very much, you two. Thank you, Pete. Thank you, Akira, for joining me on this wonderful episode of Rack Addict After Hours. To our audience, thank you so much for tuning in, and I do hope you tune in again next week as well. We've been the Rack Addicts crew, and we'll catch you next time. Farewell!